my name is John Chung. Thank you for listening to Totally Awesome Films, where I discuss some of the greatest films ever made. Each week, I watch a movie, talk about what I thought of the movie, research a little bit about how it got made, and discuss why I think the film is totally awesome. I'd like to warn listeners that this is a spoiler podcast, so if you have not seen the movie and do not want to be spoiled by information presented here, I recommend that you turn off the podcast, watch the movie, and return after you've seen the movie so that you can better enjoy this show. For this podcast, we're going to talk about GoldenEye and the introduction of the Pierce Brosnan James Bond. Now, I was really happy when Pierce Brosnan was announced as the next James Bond, and I thought he'd be great. I mean, I had so much expectations of this film that I really think that there was probably no way that it could have measured up to my expectations, and of course it didn't. So I saw this film in the theaters opening weekend, and I enjoyed the film enough, but I felt that there was something missing. I mean, I love Pierce Brosnan. I thought he was cool. I thought he was confident. He had plenty of swagger. But there was just something missing about the overall movie. And, you know, like, I enjoy a movie when I get that full immersive experience, when I watch the movie, and this feeling of being lost in the world of the movie. You know, For Your Eyes Only gave that to me. Octopus gave that to me. From Russia with Love and Goldfinger gave that to me. But this didn't quite do that. Although I did feel that Pierce Brosnan was off to a great start. I have to admit, when I saw this movie today for this podcast, it was much better than I had remembered it. And what I liked about this movie is that this movie was about something. Now, I don't think all movies need to be about something to be successful, but given that a movie is good, it doesn't help to be about something. And this movie certainly is. Now, for me, for a movie to be good, it has to be entertaining. But also, for a Bond movie to be good, I have certain criteria. For example, all James Bond movies must be cool, and 007 himself must have swagger. Yeah, he does in this. And given that he does, it doesn't hurt for a movie to be about something. And when a movie is about something, it should do it in a very subtle way that never distracts from the entertainment of the movie. And what I see this movie being about is this movie is an answer to the question, is there room for a character like James Bond in this new, peaceful, post-Cold War age where there's equality between men and women and misogyny is no longer tolerated? And seen from that angle, this movie answers that question loudly with a trumpeting but clever yes. This is a very good James Bond movie. Now, I still don't think this movie's as good as Casino Royale or Skyfall, nor is it even as good as For Your Eyes Only, Spy Who Loved Me, or From Russia with Love, or Goldfinger, but I do think it is one of the better Bond movies. And it has steadily risen in the ranks and now ranks itself solidly as a middle to top middle tier movie. Initially, Timothy Dalton was offered the role of Bond in this movie directly after License to Kill. But the MGM producers did decide that John Glenn and Richard Maybaum were too stuck in the past and needed to be replaced. Shortly thereafter, Richard Maybaum, who had written 12 out of the last 15 Bond movies, passed away at the age of 81. Now, what delayed this movie would be the legal disputes. There's some interesting legal things that happened backstage that are really worthy of some of the best Bond escapades. See, at that time, after License to Kill, Eon Productions was being distributed by MGM UA and was in the danger of being taken over by a corrupt Italian businessman named Giancarlo Peretti. And he was doing this hostile takeover for MGM UA. Now, Peretti was also known for bank fraud and writing bad checks in Europe. And even before owning MGM UA, he had already sold off the Bond rights to different companies to finance the MGM merger. Now, if you think about that, that is blatantly corrupt, but he did it. And interesting, one of the deals that he made was to Ted Turner, who began running James Bond films on his TNT network without permission from Eon Films. Remember, Peretti did not own MGM yet, so he had no right to be doing this. And really, Ted Turner had no right to be airing the James Bond movies either. Peretti was just a con man, albeit a very high-stakes con man. Peretti almost succeeded with this, but he was stopped by Eon Films, who sued Peretti and stopped the merger. and was able to tie up this merger in the courts long enough that the suit was eventually joined by Blake Edwards, creator of Pink Panther. Remember, MGAUA also owned the rights to the Pink Panther, and apparently Peretti was doing the same thing with the Pink Panther franchise. The combined lawsuits was able to stop the merger, and during the lawsuit, European authorities caught up with him, and Peretti became wanted in both Europe and the U.S. for securities fraud, and this made MGMUA and the James Bond franchise safe. So, originally this movie was written for Timothy Dalton, who was offered a chance to be in the third movie, but these legal problems really lasted over 5 years. And Timothy Dalton was waiting, and he waited, and in 1994, 5 years after License to Kill, when Timothy Dalton was on the set of the TV movie Scarlet, where he was starring as Rhett Butler, the sequel to Gone with the Wind, and on April 11th, 1994, he actually officially announced that he was resigning from the role of James Bond. Now, at this time, when Ian was casting for a new James Bond, it was assumed that Pierce Brosnan would be the next Bond, but Liam Neeson, Sam Neill, Hugh Grant, Mel Gibson were all considered anyway. And, you know, we all know that Pierce Brosnan was offered the role in 1987. He was a relative unknown and just having starred in one TV series, Remington Steele. Well, now he was a veteran movie star, having starred in a dozen major motion pictures, including The Lawnmower Man and Mrs. Doubtfire. Now, incidentally, this is the first James Bond movie that is not based on an Ian Fleming story. And this is the second film after License to Kill that is not named after an Ian Fleming title. GoldenEye is named after the Ian Fleming Beach House in Jamaica, where he wrote all of the Bond movies from 1952 to 1964. The phrase GoldenEye is apparently a reference to a British Secret Service operation, and it was actually the contingency plan the SIS had in case the Nazis invaded Spain. Now, Ian Fleming, remember, was a military officer, and he was involved in that plan. Now, for a director, they offered this film to Hong Kong action star John Woo, who then turned it down to make Broken Arrow. And eventually, the next year, he would go on to make Face Off. They then offered it to Rennie Harlan, who had just made Die Hard 2, and he turned it down so he could make Cutthroat Island with his then-wife, Gina Davis. So the job went to Martin Campbell, who was primarily a British television director at the time, and he did a few B-list movies, but this is going to be his first major motion picture. And since GoldenEye, he's done a lot of movies. He's done Mask of Zorro, he's done The Legend of Zorro, and he also would come back and return and do my favorite personal Bond film, Casino Royale, starring Daniel Craig. Incidentally, he also went on to direct Green Lantern with Ryan Reynolds, but I'll try not to hold that against him. So this is the final James Bond film that Albert Cubby Broccoli saw. And he must have been happy that his franchise was in good hands. And this will also be the first film where his daughter, Barbara Broccoli, will come on as full producer, along with her half-brother, Michael G. Wilson. And since we have a new Bond, I thought it would be interesting to present here this weird sort of conspiracy idea that some people have. It's not true, but it is kind of a fun thing to think about. And I was wondering if anyone's ever heard of this. Have you heard of the idea that James Bond is not really a reference to a person, but more of a title, and that various spies throughout history adopt the name of James Bond? And this would explain why Sean Connery is different from Roger Moore, who is different from Timothy Dalton, who is different from Pierce Brosnan. It's kind of an intriguing idea that they really are different people. They're just adopting the title of James Bond, which is an identity they adopt once they get promoted to the 007 title. I think it's an intriguing idea. It's not true. James Bond is supposed to be a single character, but it is a concept that is out there and that every James Bond fan should be aware that there is this theory floating out there. Okay, now back to the movie. So the film opens up with a dam and Bond running to the center of the dam, and we don't see his face yet, but we see the bottom of the dam, and then we see the point where he's going to land, and then the camera pans up, and it pans up and up, and the camera just keeps panning up, and we realize that Bond is going to bungee down this insane height. Pause for a moment, and then he dives. And it's a great first shot. The stuntman actually dove 722 feet, setting a Guinness Book of World Records for the highest bungee jump ever. Then Bond rappels down into the bathroom, and it makes me wonder, because it's an odd choice to start a movie, rappelling into a bathroom, and was it a metatextual symbolism for the series? Was Pierce Brosnan dropping into a mess that had become the Bond franchise in order to clean it up? Well, I'm not sure, but it's at this time we get a glimpse of an upside-down Bond, and then we get the full view. Pierce Brosnan Bond holding a gun in the classic Bond pose, and he looks great. He looks better than Timothy Dalton, better than Roger Moore, and just based on looks, he looks better than Sean Connery. He is insanely handsome, and he's clearly the best-looking Bond yet. Now, he has the look. Can he deliver the goods? So he then runs into 006, Sean Bean, who is now known as Ned Stark. Before that, he was Boromir, and here he plays Bond's predecessor. And we immediately get the metatextual significance. New Bond versus an old Bond. Now, originally, this part was going to go to an older actor who was supposed to be more of a mentor than a contemporary. And you can see the true subtext then. And Anthony Hopkins was originally set to play Alex Trevelyan. Incidentally, Alex Hopkins would also go on to play Zorro in director Martin Campbell's next movie. So you can see the connection there. Now, I don't know if this is intentional or not, but Sean Bean as 006 kind of looks like Roger Moore in his youth and talks like Timothy Dalton. So the symbolism, whether it was intentional or not, is working for me here. Then 007 says an old Roger Moore line for England. And now, at least for me, I'm certain that I'm not reading too much into this. Now, I like the way Pierce Brosnan moves here. He's got this confident swagger, but there's also a cold ruthlessness as well as a lightning-swift athleticism that's been missing in all the other previous Bond films. In fact, Pierce Brosnan did do many of the stunts himself and did almost all of the fight scenes himself. And it shows in this more convincing performance. Now, when I saw this movie back in 1995, I thought it just didn't feel right. You know, I mentioned that I felt like it was missing something. And in retrospect, what I was probably reacting to was the fact that this is the first James Bond movie that Richard Maybaum was not involved in. Now, you know, Richard Maybaum had written License to Kill, The Living Daylights, A View to a Kill, Octopussy, The Spy Who Loved Me, The Man with the Golden Gun, Diamonds Are Forever, On Her Majesty's Secret Service, Thunderball, Goldfinger, From Russia with Love, and Dr. No. So whether you like the campy jokes or hate the one-liners that's become the James Bond movie franchise, what you're reacting to is Richard Maybaum. That's right. Richard Maybaum has pretty much been the James Bond film franchise. And this film is different. This is when I noticed it, like during this viewing. So for example, in the opening teaser, when the Soviet soldiers are circling Bond and he hides behind this explosive gas canister, and the Russians can't shoot because if they do, they're going to blow him up. Well, if this were Richard Maybaum's script, I'm sure he would have said some one-liner like, you know, ready for a blast or something like that. But instead, what we get is we get the wheels are squeaking. See, it's funny and there's humor, but the humor's more subtle. So we get a pretty good opening teaser and we get a pretty good song. And then we start the movie by Bond driving his car. And we already sense that this is a very different Bond than Timothy Dalton. Now, keep in mind, though, this movie was originally written for Timothy Dalton, but I feel that it's already a different movie, because Brosnan just oozes swagger. I mean, he has a smirk on his face that says, you know, I'm having a great time. And in many ways, he has the confidence of Connery, he has the suave sophistication of Roger Moore, and yet he does have this cold, dark edge of Timothy Dalton. And at the same time, he never loses his cool. So I do think he is a great James Bond. Now, after four Bond films, I have to say, it's too bad that he never got to be in a great James Bond film. Because I really think that he had potential to be the best Bond, but the movies let him down. We also meet the femme fatale in Xenia Onatopp, who played by Famke Janssen. She was cast when producers saw her in The Lord of Illusions, and this movie is going to propel her to superstardom. Of course, now she's much better known as Jean Grey in the Marvel's X-Men franchise, but she's also been in 100 roles since GoldenEye, and here she plays a psychotic assassin who kills her victims by strangling them with her thighs, and she also has these orgasms when she kills them. So while she is over the top, Famke Janssen is so beautiful and plays this character with just the right balance that she avoids being too campy, so, and I think she's a very memorable Bond character. We also meet two computer programmers, Boris and Natalia. Boris, of course, is played by Alan Cummings, and it's hard to believe that he was a relative unknown at the time. He's mostly just done minor TV work, and this is his first major motion picture, but of course he's going to be propelled to superstar status, and will also play Nightcrawler in X-Men 2, along with Famke Janssen. And Boris here just plays this incredibly sleazy, sexually harassing programmer that's such a weasel that you're just kind of begging for him to get killed. The Bond girl Natalia is played by Swedish model Isabella Scorupo, who does an adequate job here. She's beautiful, she's charming, she's tough, but unfortunately is also largely forgettable. Now, I like the actress who played Miss Moneypenny. Her name is, get this, Samantha Bond, and she's going to play Moneypenny in all the Pierce Brosnan films. And she's cute, she's tough, and she has this great chemistry and banter with Pierce Brosnan's James Bond. Now, we also meet M, and she is played by the incomparable Judi Dench. And this, of course, is the first time M is played by a woman. And it fits with the tone of the film. Actually, the idea to have a female M was originally suggested by Lois Maxwell, who played Moneypenny in all the previous movies. And during A View to a Kill, she suggested to have Moneypenny be promoted to M, where she would be Bond's new boss. And Lois Maxwell really did want to play M, and I think it is an intriguing idea. Well, when Judi Dench was cast as M, fans did not react well to the idea of M being a woman. However, the second people saw her performance, all doubts disappeared. Now, it should be mentioned that the actual head of British intelligence, the general director of MI5, at the time was actually a woman. Stella Rimington held the top position from 1992 to 1996. So not only is it appropriate for the theme of the film, but it actually reflects real-world events of the time. And Judi Dench is wonderful here. I mean, she's tough, she oozes charisma, and I get chills every time I hear her talk. At one time, she even accuses Bond of being, quote, a sexist, misogynist dinosaur, unquote, and with a clear subtext aimed at the franchise. And she is totally a sign of the times. She's tough while being feminine, and she's totally believable as MI6's top spy. She's awesome, and it's one of the best things about this movie. So here's something cool. Now, in this script, we get M's real name. It's never mentioned in the movie, but it is mentioned in the original script. It was probably a throwaway line then, but it's going to become significant since Judi Dench will play M in the next 7 movies, and she is by far the best M, and arguably one of the best supporting cast members of the entire franchise. So, what is her name? So here we go, drum roll. Her name is Barbara Maudsley. We also meet Q again, played by Desmond Llewellyn, and we're introduced to Bond's new car. Now, while Sean Connery's Bond drove an Aston Martin, Roger Moore's Bond is associated with a Lotus Esprit, Pierce Brosnan's Bond is going to be associated with the BMW. And here we're introduced to the BMW Z3 Roadster. And I think the filmmakers made a huge mistake not to include a car chase in this movie. They introduced a car, but never use it, and this is a mistake. You remember, I've talked about Chekhov's gun. It's a literary principle created by Anton Chekhov, which says, if you introduce a gun in Act 2, it must go off in Act 3. And the director breaks that cardinal rule here. He introduces us to a Bond car, even mentions some gadgets like, quote, 5 forward gears, all points radar, self-destruct sequence, and behind the headlights, Stinger missiles, unquote. And this raises our expectations. And then he totally lets us down by never showing the car again. It was a huge mistake, and one I wonder if this film ever really recovers from. We also meet CIA contact Jack Wade, who is the new Felix Leiter. Remember, Leiter lost his limbs in the last movie when he was fed to sharks, and this movie keeps up with that continuity. But Jack Wade looks familiar. He's actually played by actor Joe Don Baker, who was the villain Brad Whitaker in The Living Daylights. See, Joe Don Baker was a good friend of director Martin Campbell and played a similar character in another Martin Campbell film called The Edge of Darkness, so he was a director's top choice to play this character. Actually, he's the third actor to play multiple roles in a James Bond film. Walter Gotell played the villain Morenzi in From Russia with Love and returned to be General Gogol in 5 movies. And Charles Gray played Henderson in You Only Live Twice and then Blofeld in Diamonds Are Forever. We also get one of the coolest fight scenes in the history of the franchise, which is the hot tub battle scene between James Bond and Onatopp. And it's really one of the most memorable scenes in the franchise. Because we're really not sure if they're fighting or making love, and for a moment, we feel that even Bond isn't sure. And there's one scene where he gets up and calmly walks away and kind of reaches for his gun, and it's great. And she just kind of jumps on him and attacks him from the back. But Bond never loses his cool, and it's a more clever scene that holds up on multiple viewings. It's a fun scene, it's a very sexy scene, and I think Martin Campbell just nails it. It's brilliant and is totally worthy of the Bond franchise. And then we come to the big action sequence of this movie. James Bond hijacks a tank and plows to the streets of St. Petersburg. And this is also the first time we hear the classic James Bond music. And it sounds great here. It's a great scene, and one that I didn't really appreciate when I first saw it in theaters. And it holds up better in today's viewing. I like how James Bond never loses his cool, and even takes time to adjust his suit while driving this tank. And then what happens? A statue of a charging horse falls on top of it. So it's a great scene, full of subtle humor, and very worthy of the Bond franchise. This movie was made on a modest budget of $56 million. Now, it may be high for a Bond movie, but it's fairly low for a Hollywood blockbuster. Remember, the same year, Waterworld was made for $172 million, and Batman Forever, which also came out the same year, was made for $100 million. And keep in mind that the next Bond movie is going to cost $110 million. So for GoldenEye to only be made for $56 million is pretty good. So GoldenEye made $106 million in the box office, making it the highest box office success of any 007 film, beating Moonraker's record. It went on to make a staggering $354 million worldwide, also making it the highest money-making 007 up to that time. This is also an important moment where the James Bond films took another step into the modern age. And this film would usher Bond back into the big leagues. Now, this film was a moderate critical success, but since then, it has steadily climbed in the rankings and is now regarded as one of the more highly regarded Bond films. It holds an impressive 84% on Rotten Tomatoes, and it is the 7th highest rated Bond film on that site. However, this movie left another legacy outside of the movie itself, and that is in the video game movie tie-in, which actually came out a year later. GoldenEye 007, released in 2007 by Rare Limited, which came out for the Nintendo 64, was a first-person shooter similar to, at that time, Castle Wolfenstein 3D and Doom. Now, I remember it had a split screen, and you could have four friends play against each other, and it was a fairly new concept. It was a huge success, and, you know, probably responsible for the fad of the first-person shooters. You know, other first-person shooters followed, like Rainbow Six, Medal of Honor, Counter-Strike, and all of these would lead to two of the greatest video game franchises in all of modern history, which is Halo and Call of Duty. Now, at this point, it looks like the James Bond franchise is off to a pretty good start, with lots of potential. Now, what do they do with it? Well, we'll discuss that next time when we talk about the 1997 Tomorrow Never Dies. Well, that's it for this podcast. Now, if you like this podcast, please go to our Facebook page, Totally Awesome Films, and like the page. And please leave a comment. It's the best way for us to have a two-way dialogue and discussion about the films. Also, please subscribe to Totally Awesome Films on iTunes. It's totally free. And if you have an iPod, it'll automatically download new episodes into your iPod so that you can listen to it in your car. Also, if you have time, please leave a 5-star rating. It is the best way for our show to show up on search engines. So please join us next time for a discussion of Tomorrow Never Dies. Thank you for listening, and I hope you had a great time.